This week on Pass Gas, we're diving into the history of Cadillac Part 1. We're talking about their origins, like at the turn of the century, all the way up to the 80s, from horseless carriages to 22-foot land boats that guzzle gas like none other. And we got Christina Felski here today.
Yep.
We got RussellJimmy.jpg.
I know what's going on.
None of us do. Let's get into it. These days, when we think about luxury cars, our minds jump to the European auto giants. Mercedes, BMW, Audi. However, for the first 75 years of car history, it was an American company that represented the peak of automotive sophistication. That brand was Cadillac. In fact, Cadillac didn't just mean a great car. A Cadillac could be anything as long as it was really, really good. World War II era Mustang fighter planes were admired as the Cadillacs of air combat. Hillquist sold the Cadillac of all trim saws. And Huffy's children bicycles were advertised as Cadillac of the sandpile set. Back then, Cadillac was literally a synonym for quad. The company's well-earned slogan was the standard of the world. But why did Cadillac become the definitive American car company? How did their cars go from glamorous and avant-garde to conservative and unremarkable? And how did they bounce back? Today on the Cadillac of Past Gas episodes, we're tackling the history of Cadillac automobiles. Part 1. Fins up!
Big thanks to Yamaha for sponsoring this podcast. Life's an adventure. Share the journey. Check out the all-new Wolverine R-Max 41000 at YamahaMotorsports.com and see your local Yamaha dealer today. Always protect the environment and wear your seatbelt, helmet, eye protection, and protective clothing. Read the owner's manual and product warning labels before operation. Thanks, Yamaha.
Now back to the show.
Ooh,
fins up. I think that's the Marlins slogan.
Yeah.
Or not the Dolphins.
I don't know anything about sports.
It's the Miami Dolphins slogan.
Well, I know things about Dolphins, and I know they've got fins.
Yeah.
That's true.
And they're up.
I know at least one fin on a dolphin.
Unless they're doing one of those cool little flippies that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Their fins are up.
Also, Miami Dolphins, also pet detective.
Yeah.
I think of it every time.
Dan Marino.
I think of Dan Marino every single time. Can you imagine? Like, because I wasn't a football fan, and but my family's we're a Jim Carrey family.
Yeah.
You know, big Jim Carrey people. But I can't imagine being like, yes, this is a respected football player I know and love, and he's an Ace Ventura pet detective. I always think that stuff's so funny. I've never heard it called sand pile instead of a sandbox.
I think that's back to the opener. 50s slang.
I know, but did they not have a box for the sand?
And also, you never ride your bike
I think
a
back
sandbox.
Then there was just sand everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what...
That was before the great sand shortage of the 90s.
Yes.
Sandbox weren't invented until, 1983? Yeah.
That goofy little voice you hear is Jimmy, a.k.a. Jimmy Milton.
I'm a sandbox entrepreneur and salesman. If you're looking for sandboxes, I got them at cheap and affordable prices. Come on down.
Also joining us is Christina Felski.
I'm a sandbox critic, and I hate Jimmy sandboxes.
Oh, no. There's going to be sparks on this show.
Uh-oh. Sales are in the toilet. Or should I say in the sandbox?
Oh, my
okay.
God.
Enough. It's run its course. Welcome to Pass
Gas. Joe's already sick of us.
I should mention that Nolan is out the whole month shooting Hilo and shooting his wedding.
Yes.
Which will not be on Donut's main channel.
Yeah.
It sure won't.
The live stream for that was just too much of a lift, I think.
Yeah, it was difficult.
Came over last night or during the day and they met my baby. And we talked about, because I'm officiating his wedding. So they were like, we want this and this. They're very, they know what they want, which is great.
Of course.
Because I don't have, that takes some work away from what I, but then I handed Nolan my baby, and the pictures are so funny.
The picture's so good.
It's like he's like so freaked out to be on Nolan. We'll put it. A picture.
Oh, can you? Yeah. Okay, cool. Put the picture. I didn't know if you're showing pictures of.
No, I am.
Of the boy.
Yeah. I for the first 6 weeks, I was putting Instagram a handsome Squidward filter on his face.
But now you're just like, nah, he's fine.
Yeah.
He's handsome already. Doesn't
yeah.
he?
He's got your eyes. He really does.
If you saw a picture of me as a baby, he's a clone.
Yeah.
It's really crazy.
He's so... And I feel bad because now I'm going to say he's so goofy looking. No. But I mean it like he has so much personality in his face.
Yeah.
Like he already does. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this kid is going to be so funny.
This is my baby.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
If, for audio listeners, if you've ever seen Paul Rudd on Conan show the clip of Mac and Me.
That is
my baby.
He's the wildest little alien. Movie. We'll also put that right here.
Wildest movie.
Not the clip, but just the face.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's totally him. He's so cute. But yeah, he's such a little character. He's such a little goofy little character.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see him on SNL.
Yeah.
He's going to make it.
And it's going to be crazy because
season 106.
Yeah.
Well, no, because he's going to be the first 5-year-old.
Yeah.
He's going to learn how to talk and then he's going to start pitching sketches.
Yeah, he's already in UCB 201 right
what?
Now.
Oh, wow.
I'm not even there.
Jimmy
this guy's funny.
Jimmy was asked to leave.
They thought I was too funny.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Jimmy, what do you think about Cadillac?
They're a big American car brand, and by big, I mean their cars are big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Land barges, right?
Christina, do you like Cadillacs?
If I wanted to drive a boat, I'd drive a boat.
It's fun driving boats.
I like boats.
I learned to drive on a 85 Grand Marquis, and that thing was like 21 feet long.
Dude, that's nuts.
And you take a right, you like turn, and then you feel it go the whole thing. Like there's so much body roll, and it takes a second to actually turn. It's very fun, and people get out of your way.
My ex-boyfriend had a Caprice Classic.
Oh, yeah, that's a good car.
We were like 20 feet away from each other. Oh, you know what I mean? Like I'd be riding, I'd be like, hello. Like you can't like scratch the back of their head. You'd have to be like,
yeah, punch him.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, normal driving stuff.
There's certain eras of Cadillacs. I like obviously the 50s tail fin era, but then it's a long stretch. And then I like the CTS V wagon.
Mm-hmm. Those are like, cool.
You know, if I was a dad in 2011, I would have definitely bought a CTS V wagon.
All the dads in Santa Monica, I feel like, had them during that time. Like, I would see them constantly.
Yeah. I think the Blackwing is sick.
That's a sick one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a, like, 40-year period where I just don't really care for them.
Yeah. What happened?
What happened? That's what we're going to find out today on Past Gas Cadillac Part 1.
Fantastic.
Let's jump into it.
If you want to get technical, which we always do, the history of Cadillac starts before the founding of America itself. Oh, my God. Greg? Greg Nix.
No. This is a good section.
Okay.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. In the late 17th century, a French military expedition to the Americas established Fort Pontchartrain in the river straits between Lake Erie and Lake Huron, or as they called the straits in their native language, Le Detroit. Jesus. Motor City was born, thanks in part to the leader of that expedition, a French noble named Antoine Lomé de la Mothe, Sieur de Cadillac.
That's where they got the name.
That's where they got the name. That's wild.
Yeah.
Okay. However, by the mid-1800s, the Cadillac name had fallen into historical obscurity, and it only reemerged because of a future automobile legend named Henry Leland. Leland was an engineer and machinist who learned his trades by working in New England factories as a child laborer in the 1850s. Oh,
he learned his trades.
He sure learned his trades. Like your son, but with comedy.
Yeah. He's going to learn the ropes.
There he developed into a perfectionist with an unmatched work ethic, while somehow not losing a single limb to heavy machinery. Incredible. Over time, he worked his way up from the factory floor to become an accomplished engineer. In 1890, Leland co-founded the engineering firm Leland and Falconer alongside a wealthy lumber industrialist partner. What happened to lumber industrialists?
You know,
I'm sorry.
Big Pine?
Yeah, Big Pine or like any kind of like, no one's like, I'm an industrialist now.
I think entrepreneur is the word.
Yeah, I think entrepreneur, because like industrialist means that you're polluting.
But wouldn't you like kind of dig it if someone was on TikTok and they're like, I'm a robber baron? Because for me, I'd be like, yes, a robber baron. Bring me back to a simpler time.
Yeah. Where you can just exploit workers.
Yeah, you know, they're doing it anyway.
We look back at those people as like these horrible money-grubbing people. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the disparity between like worker pay and CEO pay, now it's like so much worse than it was.
Totally unreal. And also back then too, they would also like, I assume for tax evasive reasons, like at least like start museums. And like other public works projects like put their names on things. Mm-hmm.
Didn't Rockefeller fund all the libraries in the U.S. or something like that?
I don't know if that's true, but I'm going to say it's true.
Wasn't like Mount Rushmore was.
Yeah, but that's not. That's blowing not, up a sacred mountain isn't
yeah,
the same as like
bad.
Providing free literature.
That's true.
Yeah, let's put a bunch of white guys on this sacred Native
I'm not from this country. I'm not from here.
That's true. Jimmy is Australian despite the California accent. But yeah, I just think it's interesting. We just don't fund the arts anymore. Okay, anyway. So Leland and Falconer, their main work was designing and building specialty tools, and they found quick success thanks to Detroit's industrial boom, which was the whole reason Leland moved to Michigan in the first place. In 1896, Leland and Falconer expanded from making tools to building engines, both steam and industrial powered. The steam engines were used for Detroit tram cars, while the gasoline engines were used for boats. That's why Cadillac's so big. Sorry. These power units helped spread word about Leland's engineering genius, and in 1900, he was approached by Raymond Olds to help solve a transmission problem they were having in the brand new Oldsmobile.
That's a sick last name.
Yeah. Oldsmobile is already old.
I also love that it's just Oldsmobile. It's just the guy's name.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know Ford is too, but
I
like
need to make a car company.
Yeah. Hilton Mobile.
Yeah.
Hillmobile. Hillmobile is kind of sick.
That sounds like a Playmobile though.
Webmobile.
Yeah. Webslinger.
Webslinger.
It's just a car that shoots. It shoots ropes.
What material are the ropes made out of, Joe?
You don't want to know.
It's a lot of work.
Stop.
Each car takes about 1 year to build.
Oh, my God. All right. So Olds was so happy with Leland's work that in June 1901, he awarded Leland and Falconer a contract to build 2,000 Oldsmobile engines. The rest of the Oldsmobile engines were being produced by two experienced mechanics. The Dodge brothers.
Never heard of them.
Ever heard of them?
No.
Nope.
They were redheaded. I know that because I wrote about them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Really? But thanks, I think. I believe second they guessing. Have red hair. Now I don't know. Now I'm scared because I have a microphone in front of me. I just make wild claims at whenever I want in real life.
Well, I just said that Rockefeller funded libraries.
Which again, we're saying is true. we've already established that's a fact.
Welcome to Pass Gas.
Do not use us as sources for papers. Okay. So, but thanks to Leland's engineering skill and eye for detail, his engines outperformed the Dodge versions in a factory test. 3.7 horsepower to 3 flat.
That's a lot of horsepower.
That's, you know, what, maybe 17%?
Actually, that's not even a horsepower because we did the calculation. It was like 5.9.
Oh.
One horse makes 5.9 horsepower.
Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, that's so true.
It is like one horsepower. I don't know.
It's a half a horsepower.
Yeah.
Don't use us for research. Okay. So.
How many cups of coffee have you had?
4.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You're looking like somebody feed Phil out here.
I am somebody feed Phil out here.
I can't watch that show.
I know. His face is too much, it's dude. Too
is
much.
That really it?
And he has nothing to add to it. He's like, wow, I've never had a chicken sandwich before. This is great.
Seinfeld was crazy back in the day when we were writing it.
My good friend, Ray Romanos.
Okay.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Big thank you to our sponsor this week, Yamaha. Guys, life is an adventure, and it's time to let more people in on the fun and share the journey. Introducing Yamaha's latest terrain-conquering side-by-side that combines class-leading power with maximum comfort and versatility. The all-new Wolverine R-Max 4-1000 has ample room for four adult passengers. They better, four of me in there, that's a lot of room. Plus, plenty of cargo space so you can tackle new terrain, expand your horizons, and go further than ever before. Side-by-sides are pretty much roller coasters that you control. These things are super fun. If you've never ridden in a side-by-side or driven one, get down to your Yamaha dealer. Go for a little test drive if possible. You won't regret it. Experience its capability at YamahaMotorsports.com and see your local dealer today. Always protect the environment and wear your seatbelt, helmet, eye protection, and protective clothing. Read the owner's manual and product warning labels before operation.
Now back to the show.
Okay, the experience of working with Olds encouraged Leland, who believed he could be very useful in helping to improve the early auto industry. Leland began experimenting with an Oldsmobile engine in his factory. By enlarging the intake and exhaust and increasing the valve diameter, he was able to triple the engine's performance up to 10.3 horsepower.
That's awesome. Now we're talking.
Now we're getting some horses. Leland brought the new engine to Oldsmobile, but Olds turned down his improvements because implementing the changes would have delayed production and made the cars too expensive. Leland was disappointed, but contented himself by installing the improved engine in his own personal Oldsmobile and returned to work at Leland and Falconer. Dude, that's he's like, fine, I'll take my toys and go home.
Yeah.
Take my toys out of the sand pile and I'll go home.
I guess all
it's a sand pile. Oh, sand pile at this point.
It's a sand pile at this point in time.
The Cadillac of sand pile.
It is. Yeah. During the same period in Detroit, car companies were springing up like weeds and often dying off even quicker. In 1902, Leland was approached by one of these failed car companies. William Murphy and Lemuel W. Bowen were partners at the Henry Ford Company, a precursor to the Ford Motor Company.
Lemuel is a wild name.
Lemuel is, I've never. I was like, first time seeing and reading this word at the same time.
Yeah, it's like, how dare you?
Mm-hmm. If your name is Lemuel, please email us. I want to know if this name lasted.
We'll send you a shirt.
We will send you a shirt. Yeah. If your name is actually Lemuel.
Letter from 1890. Being like,
time travel ass shit. Yeah. That'd be sick. Comes in a bottle. All right, the two men had a dispute with Ford over the direction of the business, so Ford and his assistant engineer quit. Without anyone to build their cars, Murphy and Bowen decided to liquidate their factory and went to the experienced Leland to appraise how much their industrial equipment was worth. Leland appraised their factory as requested, but after presenting them with his estimate, he proposed an alternative to liquidation. They could stay in business by building his new and improved Olds-based engine, which he and his son Wilfred quickly stripped out of their car to present to Murphy and Bowen.
That's cool.
I got a great idea.
Just give me like 10 minutes.
Yeah. I'm going to make some sketches and I'm going to come back with a great business plan.
And you know what? The industrialists thought so too, because they agreed. Oh. So on August 22nd, 1902, the Henry Ford Company was reorganized into what its owners hoped would become Detroit's first successful automobile company. In their minds, they were breaking new ground, so there was no more appropriate name than the one a French explorer had brought to the spot 200 years earlier, Cadillac.
I love that for them.
Yeah, that's great.
I love that for them.
It's 1902.
Yeah, we finally made it on page 3. It's 1902.
Dang, this really is a two-part episode, huh?
Yeah,
it picks up. I swear it picks up.
We're not even at the First World War yet.
Oh my God. I've already been insufferable. Where can we go? Okay.
Work on the first Cadillac car began in September 1902. It was completed just weeks later on October 17th. The car was a two-seat horseless carriage powered by Leland's 10-horsepower single-cylinder engine. Single cylinder.
Whoa.
What is it?
Kind of like my brain cells.
Nice. Two additional vehicles were finished by the end of the year. These proto-Cadillacs looked practically identical to the 1903 Ford Model A, although there is a historical disagreement over whether the Model A influenced the Cadillac or vice versa, since it was Murphy and Bowen's former Ford team who built the Cadillac chassis.
Yeah, that would be confusing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Henry and Wilfred Leland built the Cadillac engines in their old factory. The Lelands' focus on precision led Cadillac to becoming the first automobile manufacturer to use standardized interchangeable parts.
Whoa.
So like parts bin kind of thing.
That's cool.
That's crazy.
This was a critical step forward to the idea of mass car production and helped make early Cadillacs more reliable than their competitors.
How many parts do you think were in that parts bin?
Like six.
Yeah.
Really?
It was a Duplo.
And one of them was like a horse.
Yeah. It was a Lego Duplo kit, pretty much.
Oh, like interesting.
Six pieces.
Huh. So the reliability was also increased by Henry Leland's notorious perfectionism. He was known for throwing away imperfect parts on the factory floor, which he described as, quote, the only correct method to build cars.
Mm. All right, all right.
While other companies were focused on simply getting their engines to run, Cadillac's focus was quality from the very beginning.
That's it's cool. Only correct method
yeah.
to build cars.
It's crazy that, you know, like he's focusing on machine tolerance
mm-hmm.
at a time when machines were probably so primitive.
Yeah.
That's such a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. The first three Cadillacs went on display at the New York Automobile Show in January 1903. The company's biggest selling point was precision manufacturing and therefore reliability. It was quickly apparent to attendees that the Cadillacs were simply just better made than their competitors. Demand was immediate and overwhelming. The company had orders for 2,286 cars by midweek when they were forced to announce that they had sold out. In fact, the factory couldn't even keep up with the number of orders from the New York show. Between March 1903 and March 1904, Cadillac produced a total of 1,895 cars. This was actually an unprecedented number for a company in its first year of production. The auto industry was still in its infancy. Less than 12,000 cars were built that year total, and the Ford Motor Company didn't even exist until halfway through the year.
I want to know what that motor show was like in New York.
I know. That's so, like what was it? That's such
how
a
many
good
cars
point.
Were there?
Yeah, how many cars were
horseless
there?
Horseless carriages, my many, bad.
Yeah, like, but also calling them an automobile. Was it called the New York Automobile Show?
Yeah.
Thing? That's, they must have just all been like snake oil salesmen at that point.
Yeah.
This new thing.
Yeah, this new newfangled thing.
This new contraption.
It's powered by whale fat. I went down a rabbit hole of there's like this stuff that's produced in the whale in a whale's gland that once in a while they'll like throw up and will wash ashore. And it's like, it's called ambergris.
Okay, hold on.
Ambergris.
Yeah.
Oh, what? Yeah.
And it's like super valuable. And people will be like, oh, floating gold is what it's called.
It's
the
just
treasure
a
of the sea.
Gorgeous rock.
But it's like thought to be the indigestible parts of a squid. And then it just kind of gets like thrown around in a whale's digestive system, and it's used in perfume, medicine, and spice. And it was like huge in like the big ship days,
dude.
Big ship days.
Yeah.
I love big ship days. That's crazy. This is so crazy.
But there's like a subreddit where people are like, identify what I found or something, and people are always like, is this ambergris? And it's never ambergris, but once in a while it will.
How
be.
Well, can it be is that it like, rare?
It is super rare.
How is it
so you
rare,
find
though?
It in bottles now? Does it go for a lot of money?
No, you find it washed up on the shore.
Oh, got it.
And just a tiny bit can like go a long way in perfume
got
and
it.
Medicine and stuff.
What does so it smell like?
A new business venture, you're saying.
Yeah, ambergris.
Yes.
Put away those metal detectors. I'm looking for amber.
Yeah.
I don't know
oh my
how
God.
I got on the subject of that. But,
that's so interesting. Oh, well, you said you made a whale fat joke.
Oh, whale fat.
That's how.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I forced
that's
it.
How we got
yeah,
that.
We have to bring. No, you didn't force
because
it.
Because they were probably still using whale fat to burn engines.
I'm leaving this tab open so I can look at it more later.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Murphy's chassis and body departments couldn't keep up with the Leland's methodical engine deliveries. The solution was obvious, at least to Murphy. Give Henry Leland control of the whole operation. Leland initially wasn't interested in expanding his workload, but given the realities of their struggle, Murphy told him, quote,
either you come and run our factory or we go out of business.
And that settled it. On Christmas Day 1904, Henry and Wilfred agreed to direct Cadillac operations instead of being with their families and opening presents. What the hell, dudes?
We gotta build cars.
Yeah.
This meant putting aside all of their other work, so the engineering firm of Leland and Faulkner was consolidated into Cadillac, and Henry Leland became the first general manager of the Cadillac Motor Company. His salary? A cool $750 a month, or about $300,000 per year in today's money.
What?
So,
sorry.
I mean, that's a lot for a company in its infancy.
Or a startup.
Yeah, that's really a choice.
But think about, like, the CEO of Cadillac today probably makes $12 million a year, $15
million. This is per... Oh, I thought it was
$300,000 per year. So
okay, that makes more sense. Okay, I thought it was per month because the first was $750 a month.
Yeah, it would make sense to make that into per month kind of thing.
That's okay.
Yeah.
So it's 1905 now. That's where we're at.
Yeah.
Shifted 2 years and six paragraphs.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a lot.
Titanic still hasn't sunk.
Yes, yes, just to give you an idea.
Oh, they made the motor for Titanic.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no. All right.
Now that they were officially in charge, the Lelands decide to redesign their vehicle and expand in-house production of parts, so they didn't have to rely on shoddy outside vendors. Mm. Makes sense. The new operation worked like gangbusters. Between May 1904 and May 1905, Cadillac built 3,863 new cars, a 2,000-car improvement over the previous year.
Nice. Again, hand-building, and they're throwing away parts that aren't perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah, I hope they're recycling them.
I also do.
A lot of resources, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine they are recycling.
Oh, it's got a scratch on this part.
Oh, yeah. Man, it's not the right color.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm the same way.
In August 1905, Cadillac built its 8,000th car, which briefly made it the biggest automobile manufacturer in the world. Then in 1908, Cadillac cemented its reputation for quality when it was awarded the British Royal Automotive Club's prestigious Dewar Trophy for the most meritorious performance or test furthering the interests and advancement of the automobile. God dang, that's a big sentence.
I wonder what that looked like on the trophy.
I know, I was just thinking that. I was like, the door was
turning it, keep turning it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They run out of space, it just gets smaller at the end. Like, happy birthday.
Happy birthday card.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But of course, Cadillac wasn't Detroit's only automotive success story in the first years of the 20th century. In 1896, only one American company was making automobiles. Duryea.
Never heard of that.
Duryea.
Now it's Cletus McFarlane's catchphrase. Oh, Duryea.
You're watching the Cletus McFarlane YouTube channel.
Duryea, buddy. Duryea, Patriot.
Well, anyway, they produced 13 cars. 4 years later, annual production had increased to 4,192 vehicles. 4 years after that, in 1904, nearly 25,000 cars were built by 70 American auto companies. And this was just the beginning.
It's like digital coins at this point.
Yeah.
What?
Like Dogecoin, Bitcoin. Ethereum.
Oh.
Bitcoin was worth nothing at this point.
Okay, yeah, Bitcoin.
Like 0.000001.
Yeah. It's like when you look at Google usage of one, like a word or something, and it's like, only pops up in 2016 or something, but in like 1892, there was like one instance of
Cadillac coin was going crazy.
Yeah.
Such a dumb example.
Sorry, I'm a crypto bro. Can't help it.
Well, you do have a podcast, so you can't help it.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Anyway, in 1908, two things happened that would reshape the auto industry. Ford introduced the Model T and General Motors was incorporated.
Oh.
1908 was also a big year for Cadillac. They adopted their famous cursive script logo and announced the Cadillac Model 30, a wholly reimagined four-seater that would become the first car with an electric starter. Oh, dang.
1908 means that we've reached the North Pole.
Are you looking up what happened right here? Love it. Shortly after the 30 was announced, William Crapo Durant,
love that name,
of General Motors, approached Cadillac. Back in 1904, Durant bought Buick and turned it into the best-selling car in the country. Over the next few years, he turned his attention to organizing a large company covering a variety of car makes, as well as supplying component parts and accessories. The idea was ambitious and ahead of its time. Durant struggled to raise the capital he needed and failed to merge Buick and Ford. But by 1908, he used Buick's success as the foundation for General Motors and successfully acquired Oldsmobile. So Durantula made Cadillac his next target. He and Wilfred Leland went back and forth for several months before eventually agreeing to a purchase price of $4.5 million, the equivalent of about $150 million today. In retrospect, Henry Leland's biographers noted it was an enormous bargain for Durant. Cadillac was making $2 million in profit every year, which would have made it worth several times that price. But due to the unpredictability of the early auto industry, the company was undervalued.
That's also some good business strategy there.
Sure is. The deal went through on July 29th, 1909. What happened that year, Jimmy?
1909. Let's take a look real quick. 1909.
One. Two.
Let's see.
Three.
You're counting up.
Five. Stop counting in a second.
Japan and China signed the Gando Convention, which gives Japan a way to receive railroad concessions in Manchuria.
Yeah, something we all knew happened.
Yep.
Yeah.
Great. Anyway.
Not much happened in 1909.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's just say that.
All right.
1909.
Except for Cadillac became General Motors' prestige division assigned to produce large luxury vehicles. Durant positioned it at the top of GM's vehicle hierarchy above Buick, Oldsmobile, Oakland, and later Chevrolet, and granted the Lelands complete control of Cadillac's operations to keep them on board. Under GM, Cadillac continued to flourish, but Henry Leland felt that the four-cylinder engine he designed for the 1905 Model D was already outdated. Mm-hmm. European six-cylinder engines had proven themselves superior, but American companies had somewhat inexplicable trouble building them. Maybe because you're throwing all the parts away.
Yeah.
Early six-cylinder engines tested by Ford and others suffered from excessive vibration that caused crankshaft failures. So some companies gave up on six cylinders as an odd number, while others put bad engines on the market and went bankrupt.
Boo-boo.
Boo-boo. Uh-oh. Ever in pursuit of higher quality, Henry Leland wanted something more. Wilfred Leland pointed out to his father that a V-styled eight-cylinder engine had advantages over the six, including a shorter, lighter, stiffer crankshaft, a more compact size, and lighter reciprocating parts that allowed for higher engine speeds.
This is how I know it's an inline six, because it's the V8 is shorter than the six-cylinder.
Got it. That makes sense.
Several V8s had been built over the preceding decade, but only one company had tried to put it into production, Francis de Dion.
Oh, so this is the first kind of
American.
V8.
It seems like
American
it.
V8. Wow. Yeah.
That's cool.
I know this is even before Ford's V8, because Ford struggled to put a V8 on the market until basically like 32 Deuce. Yeah.
So they were kind of ahead of this.
Yeah.
That's sick. It's really cool.
Yeah. So So in 1915, the Titanic.
Yeah, that's a year jump. We're in the First World War. Titanic's gone down.
This is like
no one knows where it is. They don't even know if it's split in half.
Yeah, they don't know. They haven't seen the movie yet.
No. Yeah.
In 1915, Cadillac introduced its new 90-degree flathead V8 engine sporting 70 horsepower at 2,400 RPM, allowing its cars to get to a top speed of 65 miles per hour.
Whoa.
That's
slow down, young guy.
That's quite fast.
And that's when horseless carriages were out of a job.
All the horses had to go find new work.
Yeah.
This was faster than most roads could handle at the time.
Yeah, I would imagine. Everything's all
suspension
ruddy.
Had to be solid on these.
Mm-hmm. For sure. That's wild. So the V8 was offered in 10 different body styles, 3 open-topped and 7 closed, priced between $1,975 and $3,600, meaning the top option would have cost around $110,000 with inflation.
Ooh.
Dang. The standard body designs were intended to equal the best in custom coach work. The styling set an industry standard, which no one really changed or experimented with for a decade. And within a few years of the Cadillac V8's introduction, the American market featured at least 22 different V8 makes.
Damn.
Ford was notably not among the Cadillac imitators. They didn't introduce a V8 until 1932.
Called it.
Dang.
You did.
You can see into the future.
You sure can. According to...
Did edit this script.
I was gonna say, it's like you read this before.
I want to know what it was like in 1915 when they were like, V8? All right.
Yeah.
Let's try that out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. According to Maurice D. Hendry's book, Cadillac, Standard of the World,
a high quality car at this price and volume, 15,000 units annually, had never been produced in the United States and would remain beyond the comprehension of the European automobile industry for many decades.
Or, and as an observer later put it,
the Leland did it for the rich what Ford did for the poor.
All observers sound like that.
Hey, it looks like this is happening right now.
That's an observer.
Just a guy ordering a sandwich. Just a guy ordering a sandwich.
He somehow ended up
in anything. Yeah. Anyway, so it wasn't just rich American folks who drove Cadillacs, though. The V8 performed as an ambulance and limousine for several different countries during World War I. It was also adopted as the standard 7-passenger car of the U.S. Army. Nice. One American sergeant noted, quote,
"If I were General Pershing, I would decorate the Cadillac with Distinguished Flying Cross." Sir, yes, sir. Very. I love you.
Distinguished Flying Cross, huh?
Yeah. Hmm. However, Cadillac's efforts to help with World War I caused internal strife at the company. After the success of his cars and the effort overseas, Henry Leland wanted to start making plane engines as well. But his boss at GM, Durant, was a pacifist and refused to put aero engines into production.
Oh yeah, Durant.
Good job, Durant. He, I think, is a bad guy, though, because we've talked about him a number of times.
So he's like how Hitler was a vegetarian? Like, this guy's like...
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
I'm not making plane engines, but I will use slave labor.
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think that's true.
Child labor is cool.
I don't think those things are true. But I do recall him not being the best.
Durant scandals.
Yeah.
I want to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, check TMZ. I believe it was William.
Didn't we call him Billy? I think. Anyway, so.
Oh, right. This is Kevin Durant scandal.
Yeah, yeah. Different.
My bad.
Different. Durantula. Okay.
Flips out at LeBron for calling him Durantula.
Okay, so. Feeling that not making the planes would be an abdication of their duty to country, Henry and Wilfred Leland both resigned from Cadillac. Right. They left to found the Lincoln Motor Company.
Oh.
Ever heard of it? For the express purpose of building Liberty Aero engines, which they did to great success.
That's a good engine right there.
Ironically, Durantula bowed to political pressure, and Cadillac also began producing Liberty Aero engines soon after the Lelands left. Durant tried to woo them back to Cadillac, but they were committed to their new company.
Yeah. Despite losing its brilliant founder, over the next several decades, Cadillac continued to lead the industry in technical innovation. In 1930, Cadillac built the very first V16 engine with a 45-degree overhead valve design, which could produce 165 horsepower. Not super efficient.
1930, what are we doing then?
Yeah.
Great Depression.
Great Depression. Yes.
We finally crossed the Atlantic in a plane.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Good.
Oh, good.
A lot of good things.
Memory recall.
Not a lot of good things, but progress is happening.
Mm.
Yeah. But like a top-of-the-line Cadillac braking system, the Great Depression brought the auto industry to a screeching halt. The luxury market was hit most dramatically. Between 1928 and 1933, Cadillac sales declined by 84%.
Oh,
my gosh.
Great Gatsby wasn't buying cars anymore.
Yeah, now, for real.
Zelda, she's taking the bus.
Yeah.
Cadillac sales declined by 84% to less than 7,000 cars annually. Similar to how many they were selling in the first few years of the company.
Wow.
Exacerbating Cadillac's poor sales was an unofficial internal policy that discouraged sales to blacks and other minorities.
Oh my God.
Like other luxury car brands, many executives and salesmen at Cadillac believed that allowing minorities to own Cadillacs would diminish the brand's status among white buyers. Dealers were encouraged to avoid selling to black customers directly and to use a broker to purchase the cars on their behalf if they insisted.
What the? I don't think we've ever talked about something like this.
No, that's a bad policy.
That is crazy.
That's bad business.
Bad business.
And morally bad. Yeah, no, truly. Just like that I don't think we've ever come across this kind of grossness.
No, I mean,
there's definitely been it's a history podcast. We talk about a lot of gross, bad eras, but I don't know if that's crazy. Sorry.
I'm
sure
totally nuts.
Other car companies had similar policies, but they weren't like upfront about it.
Yeah.
This is like our writer Greg Nix read two books on Cadillac scripts, and it went super in depth about it. So, it probably just wasn't common knowledge.
Yeah, wow.
But this began to change in 1934.
Your Bonnie and Clyde were killed.
That's real?
Yeah.
Are you just making this up?
No, he's looking up stuff. He's got 1936 loaded next, I'm sure.
Nick Drystadt, previously a mechanic and the national head of the Cadillac service, was made the company's general manager. He noticed that Cadillac sales were stagnant, partly due to their limited customer base. Drystadt went before a committee that was set up to decide whether GM should continue producing the Cadillac brand. He argued that Cadillac's policy of excluding black customers was financially harmful and successfully urged the company to revoke it. Good on you, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Under Drystadt's leadership over the next few years, Cadillac gradually opened up its consumer base. The decision was driven mainly by the idea that black drivers were an untapped market, but the resulting shift helped Cadillac sales recover and began shedding the racist standards at competing companies as well. See?
I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think it's really interesting. This is the first time it's been like mentioned as a policy.
Yeah.
Formal policy on the podcast that I can recall.
Yeah.
If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'm sure
other companies like buried it.
That's what I mean. It's like, I'm sure it was there, but Jesus, it's just, yeah, wild.
In 1936,
Jesse Owens.
Yeah.
What Jesse Owens?
He won the 100 meter dash
at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that famous picture of him on the podium, mm-hmm. and the two Nazis doing the salute in second and third.
We're getting close to the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, and construction of the Hoover Dam is completed.
Oh, that's cool.
Also cool.
Do you know that
Vegas has power now?
I think either recently or it still might be happening, but the cement is still curing.
Really?
Because they poured so much cement that, you know, like when it cures, it mm-hmm. like produces heat.
Yeah.
And, there was so much cement poured in that spot mm-hmm. that the very middle of the cement is still curing.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
I wonder if someone left like a old beer bottle down there.
Oh, for sure. There's supposedly bodies.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Although I think that they'd probably like see someone fall in and be like, hey, get
him out.
Get Rick out, dude.
Rick, enough playing around in the cement.
Oh,
we got a
playing.
Dam to build.
I don't think he's playing, boss.
Oh, Rick.
So also in 1936, mm-hmm. Cadillac introduced the Series 60. It was designed to be a more affordable luxury car and priced to attract a broader customer base, which included middle-class buyers who aspired to own a Cadillac but couldn't afford the more expensive models. The Series 60 was an instant success, doubling Cadillac sales from the previous year. Its successor, the Series 61, was even more affordable and featured the latest styling trends, like streamlined designs and integrated headlights. By 1940, Cadillac was selling 10 times as many cars as its low point during the Great Depression, and it was a small but essential innovation that helped Cadillac recapture its edge over the competition. Screws.
Oh.
Mm.
Huh.
In 1934, Henry F. Phillips introduced the Phillips head screw and screwdriver to the market. Phillips contacted General Motors and convinced the Cadillac group that his new screws would speed up assembly times, therefore increasing profits.
I just can't imagine what it would be like to invent something so important.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's why I'm, for the listener who can't see me, I'm freaking out. Because I'm just like, 1934?
Mm-hmm,
my grandparents were alive.
Yeah.
Like, my grandparents were alive for the screwdriver. What?
Not the drink.
Yeah.
The little bolt.
What? And the drink.
Oh, yeah.
As a result, and the
drink.
That's
true. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just, like, I can't believe. Yeah. Anyway.
It's crazy.
To be a person who invents things is, like, just
I wonder what his sales pitch was. I got this great idea.
That's crazy.
Your screws are going to be dead.
He takes it like a flathead in and he goes, look, you try to screw it in, you slip out.
Yeah.
You try to screw it again, you slip out. You're doing that all day.
Oh, but check this. You're going to love my screws.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
And you know what? He was right.
He was. Yeah.
The Phillips head led to a revolution in assembly line technology, and Cadillac was the first automaker to start using it in 1937.
Whoa!
That's by 1940, it had become the industry standard.
That's fascinating.
Well, we all know what's happening in 1940. Just wanted to say.
Yes.
We all know.
Yes, we all knew. So while Cadillac was a leader in engineering from the start, their car's ascendance as a designer item began in the late 20s. In 1926, the company hired early automobile stylist Harley Earl as a consultant, but he ended up staying on for over three decades. Dang. They liked him.
He was permalance for a long time.
He was permalancing. Earl brought advanced new design methods like modeling with clay instead of wood or metal. But it was his focus that was really revolutionary. He tried to create visual consistency across the entire vehicle, making sure that no single element was disconnected from the overall
That's
design.
Sick. Love that.
That's great.
I feel like every car manufacturer has taken that philosophy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Design language across different models. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so cool.
That's cool.
In 1928, Earl was appointed head of Cadillac's new art and color division. The first car he designed was the LaSalle, a newer, smaller companion marquee to Cadillac. It was named after another French explorer, René Robert Cavalier, Sieur de La Salle. The La Salle marked the first time a car was designed under the direction of a professional stylist rather than an engineer or mechanic. It featured longer, lower lines, a more graceful body, and elements like chrome detailing that gave it a distinctive, refined look. Very I need refined. To look up this car.
Yeah, the La Salle.
So the La Salle was discontinued in 1940, but Earl stayed on to lead the design process at Cadillac and reinforced the, quote, Cadillac look. Open fenders, sweeping lines, and blending of components. He also designed the first cars featuring what would become Cadillac's defining trait, tail fins.
Fins up, Tyreek Hill.
Fins up. The tail fin concept originated when Earl and his assistant, Julio Andrade, saw a secret early version of a Lockheed P-38 Lightning fighter plane several years before Pearl Harbor.
That's a cool plane. P-38's cool.
Earl believed that cars... Sorry. I can't tell if you're joking.
No, I have... You want to hear my top three American World War II planes?
Yeah.
Sure, buddy.
Okay, PBY Catalina. Mm. That's great one. All right? Mm-hmm. Love that.
Mm-hmm.
B-24.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And the P-38.
Okay. Earl believed that the car should look fast, powerful, and modern, just like the planes of the era. He wanted to capture the sleek look of these aircraft and translate that into automotive design. Earl and Andrade experimented with design ideas like pontoon fenders, airplane-style cockpits, and propeller-shaped noses.
I like planes.
Let's get through this.
In 1948, Cadillac became the first automaker to introduce tail fins on its production models with the Series 62. The fins were initially subtle and modest, meant to give the car a unique futuristic appearance while also providing a visual cue inspired by aircraft design. They quickly became a definitive part of Cadillac styling and highly imitated. Fake fins popped up in accessory shops across the country. For a few dollars, you can install them and make your Chevy or Oldsmobile look like a knockoff Cadillac.
I'm just imagining like a 1950s AutoZone.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
What's it for?
Yeah. True Cadillacs continued to define the height of American auto performance and styling. In 1949, the company introduced an all-new 331 cubic inch short-stroke high-compression overhead valve V8, which set the standard for the entire American automotive industry. Time magazine announced the model on October 25th, 1948, saying the new engine could
drive a heavy Cadillac from standstill to 80 miles per hour in just 30 seconds.
Dang.
Whoa.
That's fast. I mean, yeah. As the 1950s progressed, the
Wait, do you really think it's fast? 30 seconds?
I don't think it's that
80 fast. Miles per hour in 1948?
Yeah, but like...
What's happening in 1948?
I'm thinking time-wise. You don't think that's fast? Also, here, I have to tell you this. My car is slow. You guys have seen it. The Forester is slow. I couldn't get up to 80 in 30
it's
seconds.
Probably yeah, faster than a Miata.
Yeah, I don't think I could.
It's probably faster than a Miata.
I don't know.
I guarantee it.
It's a 0 to 60 seconds. Time plus 20 more miles per hour, which you're going, it's going to go faster.
Can I get up to 80?
Yeah. 100%.
My car is so slow.
I bet you have a 19
second. It's also
second.
Weighed down as now because of all the stuff yeah. we did to it. I bet you which have is a, great. I love it. But like,
but you have a 22 second. 0 to 80 time.
I'm going to test this.
Yeah.
I'll report back.
Okay.
Okay. So as the 1950s progressed, the tail fin trend grew more pronounced. Earl continued to push the boundaries of automotive design, making the tail fins on Cadillacs larger and more dramatic each year. Like me. By the mid-1950s, tail fins had become a symbol of American automotive innovation and the cultural fascination with space-age aesthetics.
Space is in.
Space is in.
Space is in. Horses are out.
Past both world wars. Now we're in a cold one.
Yeah.
Jetsons
NASA's
time.
NASA's in. Yeah, Jetsons.
Jetsons time, baby.
Is great.
These Cadillacs capitalize on a post-World War II boom in American culture, pride, and influence. In 1955, Chuck Berry became one of the very first rock and roll stars when he hit the charts with a song about a woman named Maybelline.
Maybelline.
Who drives a Coupe de Ville. A black caddy figures prominently in Alfred Hitchcock's classic 1959 thriller, North by Northwest. During that era, everyone from Marilyn Monroe to Elvis Presley to Dwight Eisenhower had a Cadillac. True thing, when Joe told us we were doing Cadillac today, Jimmy said, Elvis Presley.
Yep.
And then he stopped talking. He just went, Elvis Presley. And we were like,
yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
True.
He like gave away at least like 100 Cadillacs, I feel like.
Really?
Yeah.
He like gave them away.
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
Oh.
I don't know the exact
number. Like a giveaway to like
No,
fans?
Like as like gifts to like friends
he, like,
and family.
Oh,
yeah, he'd
nice.
Buy them for people.
That's
and
nice.
Just be like, here, I have a Cadillac.
Can you imagine being the friend that's just like 1 degree removed from getting a Cadillac from Elvis Presley?
Oh, yeah. Everyone in my circle got a Cadillac. Elvis, that's great of you.
Wow, that's super. Oh, wow. You got one too.
I'm so happy for
Jennifer,
you.
Jennifer, great. I don't know. I don't think anyone is named Jennifer then. Anyway, the company's reputation as the epitome of luxury and style remained even as tail fins went out of style. Over the next two decades, Cadillac models like the Eldorado, the Brougham, and the DeVille helped to maintain the company's reputation as an industry leader. Each had its own unique market position. The Eldorado was sporty and stylish, the Brougham was the ultra-luxury flagship, and the DeVille was the mainstay sedan. The Eldorado represented Cadillac's dedication to combining cutting-edge technology with luxury and style. It became a symbol of personal luxury cars, a segment that emphasized comfort, design, and exclusivity. And in the early 1970s, the Eldorado became known for its massive size, bold design, and powerful, thirsty V8 engines.
What a cool name.
It is cool.
I like that.
I think, like, before cafe regulations happened in the 70s, Cadillac had like, an 8-liter V8.
Cadillac Brougham's were the peak of automotive opulence. Each one was hand-built and packed with luxury features that were ahead of their time, like air suspension and power seats. In the 1960s and 70s, the Brougham name transitioned to a trim level on the Fleetwood series, emphasizing Cadillac's most luxurious options, like longer wheelbases and unique styling cues. The DeVille became Cadillac's mainstream luxury model, appealing to a wide range of customers who sought the Cadillac experience. It was often seen as the quintessential American luxury sedan, combining a smooth, quiet ride with a commanding presence. DeVilles were also the first cars to incorporate safety innovations like crumple zones and front disc brakes.
Because there's so much space.
Yeah.
You're like,
oh,
we're going to totally. Add another 2 feet to this just so it can crumple.
Yeah. And you can also fit 101 Dalmatians.
Oh, DeVille, nice.
You sure can.
So anyway, in 1969, Cadillac sold 245,000 cars, a number that far exceeded every other luxury car manufacturer combined.
Jesus.
Lincoln, Henry Leland's redheaded stepchild company, was a distant second with around 59,000 cars sold. So almost 5 times as many cars. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the peak. Cadillac set new sales records in 1973, then again in 1978.
In the middle of a gas crisis, too.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That
huge,
is
massive
crazy.
Cars that made 110 horsepower.
Jesus.
So surely this is the end of the story, right?
Uh-huh.
Cadillac made great cars for years and years and quietly continued to do so to this very day. Not so fast.
Whoa. Twist.
What goes up must come down, as Isaac Newton theorized in his Laws of Motion, and also Murphy Lee confirmed in What the Hook Gone Be.
Greg is wild and out.
Wild. You know how they always say, and I know this is like...
I love Greg.
The term wild is not a Gen Z term, but the way that they say it in Love Island, where they're like, wow, coming back from Casa with another girl is wild.
Oh, yeah.
That it's me and Emily say that all the time. I'm like, wow, not doing the dishes is wild.
That's crazy.
Crazy. Wow. Coming back from Casa with another girl is crazy. It was definitely true for Cadillac. Over the next 20 years, the seemingly invincible automaker's massive market share gradually crashed to half of its 1978 peak. But how did Cadillac fumble so badly? Next time on Past Gas, what almost killed Cadillac? And how did it escape the Grim Reaper?
Ooh.
We will find out next week with Cadillac Part 2.
A little cliffhanger.
Ooh. Yeah. We have some listener mail. Do you want to read it, Christina?
Sure. What's up, Past Gas crew? My name is Brady, and I'm a huge fan of both Past Gas and the Big Three. I'm a big car nut, and I love hearing your guys' takes on both past and present automotive stories and news. Recently, I got my first car, a 2011 Infiniti G37X.
Oh, takeover car.
I really love the car and would like to modify it in some way, so I'm wondering if you guys could suggest any modifications I could do to it for relatively cheap to make it more personalized. If you have any tips, let me know. Keep it juiced, Brady.
Well, it's got a VQ in it.
Yep.
3.7 liter.
Intake, exhaust.
Intake, exhaust, wheels, suspension.
Yep.
Tint, wrap. I don't know. If you got money, why not get a wrap?
What do you think, Jimmy?
I'd say, you know, for cheap, I'd do intake. I would do a steering wheel.
Yeah.
Shift knob.
A seat, a nice.
Seat, depending on how nice. It's an Infiniti, so the seat's probably already, like, good condition. It's probably leather. I wouldn't do that. Probably want to lower it, though.
Yeah, yeah. Lower it.
That's what I would
be taking it to takeovers.
Yeah.
Definitely lower it. Weld the diff.
Weld the diff.
No, don't do that.
Don't weld your diff. Don't weld your diff.
There's a PS part of this, too, though.
There is. PS, if possible, I would love an episode of Past Gas covering the rally driver Ari Vatanen.
Yeah.
He is one of my favorite rally drivers, along with Travis Pastrana. He's really the star of the sport, having won the Dakar Rally 4 times.
Ooh.
Competing in Group B and more. I would be extremely grateful if there was an episode done about him.
I think we might be able to do that, Brady.
Ah.
I'm going to pull up his Wikipedia right now.
I think from off the top of my head, I think he's Finnish.
I believe he is.
All the rally drivers are Finnish. They're crazy and they're happy and they talk a lot of smack and they're fun.
Let's go into the woods.
He is Finnish and he's now a politician and a member of the European Parliament.
Oh,
or he was. He was, I'm sorry, from 99 to 2009.
Cool. Okay, cars so that might be a great story. We'll look into it,
Brady.
Yeah,
that is interesting.
If you don't follow us on YouTube, subscribe, tell your friends. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to this. I help spread the word. Follow Jimmy at russelljimmy.jpg.
JPEG. Yeah.
Follow Christina at Christina Felsky. And me at Joji Weber. If you want to write in and suggest a topic for us, email pastgas@donutmedia.com and we will consider it. We might even read your email on air. And we love you guys. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Shin.
Yeah.
Thanks, Shin.
Thank you, Shin.
Thank you to Greg Nix for writing this. And
Shin Lewis for recording
it. Skeleton crew today.
Yeah.
Small crew.
Yeah. All right. See you next week.
Bye. Bye-bye.